And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, looks like the world's been turned upside down. I've always been a firm believer in fairness. Unfortunately, the powers that be don't. Another issue is that those who are the leaders in the field, so to speak, of archaeology in this particular case, firmly believe that what they think is correct has to be correct. And if you disagree with them, your career is destroyed. Well, archaeology actually had its start back in the 1800s when wealthy folks from England and Germany and a few other countries decided to go dig in the sand of Egypt. And by guess and by God, they put together what they believe was the history of civilization. More often than not, they were wrong, but you couldn't tell them that. Now, an interesting place, and a place that seems to have connections to early civilizations, is Mesopotamia. Now, in 1853, Hormuz Rassam discovered fragments of an ancient Sumerian text that many people consider to be the first great work of literature our civilization ever produced. After its translation, it was published in 1870 by George Smith. I talked about him. He was the young man who found a part of a tablet at the British Museum and was sent to the Middle East to see if he could find the rest, and he did. Although read by serious Mesopotamia scholars far and wide, it was generally consigned to oblivion in the popular press. I mean, let's face it, nobody really cared. And sometimes the strangest things can spark the public interest. In this particular case, it was Star Trek: The Next Generation. In the second episode in the fifth season, the episode was entitled Darmok. Patrick Stewart's character, Captain Jean-Luc Picard, quoted a line spoken by King Gilgamesh. He who was my companion through adventure and hardship is gone forever. Well, it didn't take long for that statement to spark an interest in the population all over the world. And they rushed to find a copy of the Epic of Gilgamesh so they could learn more about the heroes in this epic saga. Gilgamesh, king of Uruk, and Enkidu, a wild man of the forest as he was described. Another triumph for those who trumpet the impact and resulting responsibility of popular TV shows. Now, the Epic of Gilgamesh was supposed to have been composed more than 4,000 years ago. And it tells the story of two, for lack of a better term, men. King Gilgamesh and the savage Enkidu. And how they triumphed over adversity and developed a personal friendship. Now, according to legend, Enkidu was created by the gods specifically to keep Gilgamesh from subjugating and oppressing his people. But after an epic battle, the two became friends and shared many adventures. Eventually, though, the now civilized Enkidu was given a death sentence by the gods, partly as a consequence of failing to fulfill the purpose for which he was created. Now, depressed and disillusioned by Enkidu's death, Gilgamesh undertook a long and difficult journey to discover eternal life. He didn't want to die. He believed the gods to be unfair because they created mankind with the knowledge of eternity, but without the ability to ever achieve it. And he thought this was an unforgivable act. Now, see, Gilgamesh was supposed to be a demigod. One parent was a god, one was a human. And because of the human aspect, he did not have the eternal life that the gods enjoyed. Now, the gods could give eternal life, but they had to do it as a conscious act. Now, grieving for his friend Enkidu and fearful of his own death, Gilgamesh decided to seek wisdom from Utnapishtim, one of the two survivors of the great flood that had destroyed most of humanity. And the flood was brought about because two gods named Enlil and Enki had a disagreement. They were half-brothers, and they had a severe case of sibling rivalry. Now, Enlil was the one who wanted to create the human race in the first place. He wanted a race of slaves that would serve the gods. See, according to the Sumerian tablets translated by Zacharias Sitchin, the Anunnaki came to this planet to mine it for its resources and send them back to the home planet that needed gold to keep its atmosphere in place. Now, the problem was the gods, or the Anunnaki, rank and file, weren't happy having to slave in the mines to produce the gold. So they wanted someone else to do the work while they laid around and did what gods do. Now, as a result, the local humanoid was genetically modified to create this slave creature. And since there was a shortage of raw material, they needed to make it able to reproduce. Initially, it was like the mule, the cross between the horse and the donkey, which is not fertile. But a little bit of modification of the DNA, and lo and behold, you had a creature that could reproduce itself. Well, the slave race worked diligently to please the gods until Enlil got tired of what he called the humanoids and their disobedience. So he decided to destroy them all with a great flood. And I think he disagreed. He had done the actual work of creating these creatures and making humans out of a mixture of clay and blood, and he was angry, not wanting to see his work go to waste. So he decided to help Utnapishtim and his wife escape the flood by building a boat. And the Utnapishtim was given precise dimensions to follow, finally sealing the hull with pitch and bitumen. And he loaded it with all the animals of the field, gathered his family aboard, and when the floodwaters came, they floated to safety. After a strong storm arose that terrified even the gods, he retreated to the safety of the heavens. Well, the boat eventually lodged on a mountaintop. Legend says it was Mount Ararat. And Utnapishtim released a dove, and a swallow, and finally a raven. Now, the dove and the swallow came back to the safety of the boat because they couldn't find a place to nest, but the raven didn't come back. And this convinced Utnapishtim that dry land had to be somewhere nearby, so he knew it was safe for them to get off the boat. First thing he did was offer a sacrifice to the gods. And when they smelled the sweet savor of the sacrifice, the gods responded with kindness. Surprisingly, it was Enlil himself who bestowed the gift of immortality as a reward. It would appear that even a god can occasionally change his mind about things. So because of their faithfulness, Utnapishtim and his wife were the only two humans ever granted eternal life on earth by the gods. And although they could not grant eternal life themselves, they did share a great secret with Gilgamesh. They told him about a plant that grew only at the bottom of the sea. It was called Ur-Shanabi, the plant of heartbeat. If Gilgamesh could find this plant and eat it, he'd regain his usefulness and live forever. Eventually, at great risk, Gilgamesh tied stones to his feet and allowed him to walk across the seafloor. He found the plant and came back to the shore, where he decided to share it first with some respected elders. Now, whether he did this out of kindness or as a precaution from being poisoned remains unclear. Unfortunately, when he stopped to wash off the exertions of his task, a snake appeared and stole the plant, shedding its skin as it slithered away. So the fruit of eternal life was stolen by a serpent. Gilgamesh went back home to Uruk, sadder but wiser, and was finally able to tell his story. Well, like all good mythological tales, the Epic of Gilgamesh, as it's called, generated a lot of heated religious and philosophical discussion. And although no indication exists this was ever considered a religious text, biblical scholars were quick to jump on the similarities between Utnapishtim and Noah. One very clear belief was that the Epic of Gilgamesh was the basis for the later story of Noah's flood, a tale that's been told for countless generations, which was considered by many Jews, Muslims, and Christians around the world to be a historically accurate account. So the question became, did the authors of the Bible plagiarize the Epic of Gilgamesh when they prepared the book of Genesis? And philosophers also wanted to examine the story. Was Gilgamesh being selfish and looking for immortality? If so, why didn't he just eat the plant as soon as he found it? Or did the fact that he wanted to give the plant to elders first, who had need of it, demonstrate that he was selfishly trying to bring the gift of immortality to the human race, thereby rectifying what he considered to be an unjust act of the gods? Whatever may be the case, his story, like mythology from around the world, can be read on a number of different levels. But one level is looked at as especially important. Gilgamesh undertook what mythologist Joseph Campbell called a hero's journey. While living a normal life, if you consider the life of an oppressive king normal, the loss of a valued friend caused him to confront an essential spiritual problem. And his concern about the nature of death and eternal life led him to depart from what was, for him at least, an average life experience and undertake a spiritual quest. Well, it In line with the nature of the traditional hero's journey, he traveled unfamiliar landscapes, battled strange creatures, and triumphed over adversity. He looked death in the face and survived. Sought out otherworldly entities while looking for his own holy grail, the gift of immortality that could only be bestowed by the gods. Well, in actuality, that's the nature of the so-called hero's journey. It's a call to adventure, a departure from the familiar into the unknown, a triumphal fulfillment of the quest, and return home bearing the gift of wisdom. Everybody from Dorothy in the World of Oz to Wizard of Oz, rather, to Galahad in the Arthurian Saga and Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, you have this journey. There are many philosophers who insist it's a journey such as this that each and every one of us should make if we want to live an authentic, fulfilling life. Now, some insist the Epic of Gilgamesh is based on a real historical person whose story was eventually exaggerated to mythic proportions. Others insist it's an example of classic mythology. And some think it's a fairy story meant for children. But however you look at it, it sheds light on an ancient and venerable myth. And no matter how far back in history we go, the story of the flood has always been with us. And it seems as though people have always been concerned with the same spiritual problems. There's three questions that these journeys are supposed to answer. Who are we? Why are we here? And how should we live? Now, we have leaders who believe that they can answer those questions because they're so much smarter than the rest of us. At the same time, when you get right down to it, these leaders don't know anything more than the rest of us. For example, Bezos the other day said the wealthy should have a bigger input into who becomes the president because they're smarter. And he's basing the fact they're smarter on the fact they're wealthy. Well, these three questions are essential questions that deal with what it means to be alive and a functioning member of the human race. And they're as ancient as our own origins. In fact, the ability to ponder these questions probably marked the first step in our becoming human in the first place. As far as we know, animals don't spend any time considering these things. I posed these questions to my dog who looked at me like I was crazy. In light of such questions, the day-to-day activities that usually attract our attention seem pretty trivial. After all, if you're concerned about the destiny of your eternal soul, who cares about what color you decided to paint your kitchen? Or what show you watch on TV? Or whether you have the latest electronics that everybody says you ought to have. In the end, Gilgamesh achieved his quest and came back to Europe. He brought back wisdom, but not the wisdom he wanted. What was the wisdom? Well, the object of his quest didn't lie in his immortal body, but rather in his immortal story. Since his story lived on, in a sense, so did he. What we leave behind us is not biological in nature, but spiritual. As long as people are alive who tell our story, we live on forever. And the proof of this is the fact that the first great work of literature our civilization ever produced is still being told and retold, argued about, studied, and discussed. Gilgamesh lives on in his deeds, in his ideas, in his story. Now, this is the traditional interpretation given to one of two great works of literature that came to us from this ancient, mysterious land of Mesopotamia. Now, that name came from the Greek, translates roughly as a land between two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates. And they're referenced in the Bible as two of the four rivers that rise in the Garden of Eden. Today, it's situated in Iraq, parts of Iran, Syria, and Turkey. And although this was a very troubled part of the world, it has an important story to tell in the history of civilization. Until the discovery of Göbekli Tepe, it was thought to be the place where agriculture rose between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago, which actually began the rise of civilization. Now, Mesopotamia has been excavated extensively by archaeologists who universally say they've barely begun to scratch the surface of what's yet to be discovered. And surprisingly, much of what has been uncovered supports the backstory of the Epic of Gilgamesh, the city of Uruk, where Gilgamesh was king, is a real place. And possibly the city in which one of the first written languages was ever invented. Now, when the Epic of Gilgamesh was discovered, little did people know that another great textual bombshell was getting ready to explode, beginning one of the most disputed, hotly debated arguments between disparate interpretive camps involving archaeology, mythology, history, religion, and even ancient alien believers. Four years before the discovery of the Epic of Gilgamesh, a scholar named Austin Henley Laird, while poring over the contents of material hidden away in the library of Ashurbanipal in what's now Mosul, Iraq, found fragments of a 3,800-year-old manuscript containing a Babylonian creation epic called Enuma Elish. Now, a full 27 years passed before it was finally published by George Smith, who'd early published the Epic of Gilgamesh. It told the story of seven judges of hell who ruled the land before the onset of the Great Flood. Their leader was a mysterious half-fish, half-human figure named Oannes. I've written about him. In fact, I got two new books coming out any day. One is The Ghost of Phoenix that I'll have when I go to Tucson for the book festival. And my first young adult action adventure called Chasing Villa's Gold. But my third book is called The Mystery Men. And it's about the mysterious teachers who walked out of the jungle and began to teach the survivors of the collapse of civilization the elements of creating civilization. Now, strangely, this isn't the only place that such a being appears in mythology. In the ancient ruins of Tiwanaku in western Bolivia stands an enigmatic statue. A figure seems to be garbed in the scales of a fish. In fact, Graham Hancock, in his book Fingerprints of the Gods, talks about that image. He says it's very ancient and spoke of the gods of the lake with fish tails called Cholula and Umantua. In this fish-garbed figure, it seemed that there was a curious out-of-place echo of Mesopotamian myths, which spoke strangely at length about amphibious beings endowed with reason who had visited the land of Sumer in remote prehistory. And, of course, the leader of these fish creatures was Oannes, who was a god in Sumer. So how do cultures half a world apart revere the same entity as a founding god? Where'd they get the idea of a half-fish, half-man? How is it that both Bolivian and Mesopotamian craftsmen sculpted the identical image? Was this a common memory? Perhaps a common story? Nobody really knows, but certainly it's a mystery that really does need to be solved. Enuma Elish goes on to tell the story of the god Marduk, also called Nibiru, who had in the beginning created humans as a slave race in order to serve the gods. Now, if you'll think about it, that's the very same attribute given to Enlil, who was said to be from the planet Nibiru. Now, slaves needed supervision, and to accomplish that task, he assembled a team of 600 watchers, or holy ones, who were called Anunnaki, that translates roughly to gods of heaven and earth. In keeping with their title, 300 of them were to serve in heaven, and 300 were to walk the face of the planet. Marduk was a son of the god named either Enki or Ea, also known as the god of the waters. Now, it's interesting to me that there's so many common factors between the stories from Bolivia and the stories from Sumer. Now, traditional scholars viewed the whole epic as a myth, which is interesting, and certainly, to, I guess you could say, fantastic to be considered real history. And everybody walked on happy, knowing that the powers that be said it was nothing but a myth and a legend. And then came a man that I got to know, Zachariah Sitchin. He insisted the name Anunnaki didn't mean gods of heaven and earth. He said it was better translated as those who from heaven to earth came. And even located their homeworld on a planet called Nibiru, which he claimed comes within traveling distance of Earth from time to time as it follows a long elliptical orbit through the heavens. Now, Nibiru, if you recall, was another name for the god Marduk. And the inhabitants of Nibiru, according to Sitchin, and he got this by translating Sumerian tablets, were in serious trouble. For some reason, their atmosphere needed to be seeded with gold from time to time in order to remain viable. Now, Nibiru didn't have a great deal, but luckily for them, gold was plentiful on planet Earth. But in order to mine it in sufficient quantities, the Nibiruans needed slaves, so with a little genetic DNA manipulation, the human race came into being, created, as it were, from lower life forms that already walked the face of the planet. Now, the academic battle lines were drawn and continue to hold public interest to this day. Traditional scholars insist we're dealing with mythology. Ancient alien enthusiasts support the idea of extraterrestrial DNA manipulation in our distant path. Historians wonder if the story is based on facts that have been garbled over the centuries. And to make matters even worse, the Christians stumbled onto the debate when they took to heart a popular hymn written in 1906 by Anthelstan Riley. It's called, appropriately enough, "Ye Watchers and Ye Holy Ones." And it's a staple in most hymn books today, although most believers think they're singing about angels and seraphs and cherubim, not ancient slave overseers. And even still, the matters might have retreated into the dustbins of academic debate if it wasn't for newspaper headlines that appeared in January 2016. Astronomers spotted evidence that pointed to an undiscovered planet in our solar system orbiting our sun in a huge elliptical orbit way out beyond Pluto. And although they had not yet actually seen the planet, they could figure out the number of objects, possibly moons, it had captured with its gravitational pull, so they knew it had to be pretty big. For a while, it certainly seemed as though it was a worthy candidate to replace Pluto as our ninth planet. If you recall, Pluto a few years earlier had been downsized to dwarf planet status. Now, many people disagreed with that decision, thinking that astronomers had been much too high-handed about the whole process. I mean, let's face it, folks. As school children, we were forced to memorize the names of the planet in order out from the sun. And it's easy to find it disconcerting when a small group of astronomers could arbitrarily disrupt our whole concept of the solar system. Now, this new planet exists way out behind what's called the Goldilocks zone, a narrow band neither too hot nor too cold to support life. So it certainly didn't seem to be a good candidate for the mythical planet called Nibiru. But it was hidden away outside our sight for all the time, so it was mysterious. It also seemed to be coming closer, so it was bound to set off serious speculation, especially because the whole ancient alien theory can be traced back to Sitchin's translation, Anunnaki, Those from Heaven to Earth Came. I read most of his work and had a chance to have many discussions with him. And he told a very solid story. Now, what all this means is that the Mesopotamian civilization that until recently was considered the birthplace of our civilization now had, to some people at least, a plausible genesis outside our solar system. All they needed was a belief that the universe is a very big place, that it contains life outside our planet, and that human-like life forms visited us in the ancient past. I mean, let's face it, it would be kind of presumptuous for us to assume we are the only human-shaped entities in the universe. And this immediately draws snorts of derision from those who don't believe such visitation ever took place. But to be fair, that belief too is made up much more of opinion than fact. After all, when you agree to consider the possibility, a very reasonable body of evidence exists that points to alien visitation. Once you open that door, though, it makes possible the idea that mythological gods and goddesses who brought a civilization weren't simply made-up beings or figments of the imagination of an ancient priestly class. Instead, they might have been actual entities from other planets, dimensions, or time zones who were elevated to the status of gods or angels after centuries of myth-telling and the resultant expansion of legends and stories. Of course, another explanation does exist. Scholars such as Andrew Collins and Graham Hancock trace the Anunnaki, or the Anunna as they're called by some, to at least one ancestral civilization composed of very real, but very old, human antecedents. They're the remnants of a very earthbound civilization that had survived the great cataclysm of Younger Dryas event and sought to teach the arts of civilization to our primitive Stone Age ancestors. And this theory certainly explains the sudden blossoming of symbolic thinking, astronomy, art, and architecture that burst forth on the Sumerian scene with no evidence of a previous evolutionary buildup. Now, it's difficult to ignore the text about this matter. The ancient religious literature seems to take this theory quite literally. If you look at the first seven chapters of Genesis, first seven verses of Genesis in chapter 6. When man began to increase in number on the earth, the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose. The Nephilim, some use the word giants, were on the earth in those days and also afterwards, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil all the time. Lord God was aggrieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I'll wipe out mankind who I've created from the face of the planet. So who were the Nephilim, fathered by the mysterious sons of God? Were they children of the Anunnaki, the heroes of old, men of renown? The Old Testament text comes from roughly the same geographical location as the earlier Babylonian and Sumerian stories of Mesopotamia. So you do have to ask yourself, are they all related? Do they recount religious myths or historical legends based on fact? Now the debate continues. Before we leave this theory, might prove informative to travel halfway around the world to the homeland of the Hopi. Indians of the American Southwest. In Hopi mythology, their ancient ancestors were saved from a series of catastrophes that overcame their world. The ones who came to their aid were their friends, the ant people, who gave them shelter and saw them through the worst of the destruction. In Hopi, the word ant is anu. The root word for friends is naki. So ant friends can be translated as Anunnaki, which sounds very much like the Sumerian Anunnaki. Is this a coincidence, or were the Anunnaki the heroes of old and men of renown more widespread and important than we've been taught? Well, all of this speculation revolves around what archaeologists sometimes refer to as the Sumerian problem. Even Thor Heyerdahl of Kon-Tiki fame was troubled by this vexing problem. Simply stated, when a Sumerian civilization burst onto the scene 6,000 years ago, it seemed to arrive as a fully formed, mature civilization. Archaeologists have found sophisticated jewelry, advanced city building, and fully functioning reed boats that, as Heyerdahl proved beyond doubt when he sailed across the Atlantic, were capable of crossing oceans. So how did all this appear just out of the blue? Some kind of proto-Sumerian civilization had to have existed, but if it did, where was it? Now, scientists don't like mythology very much. They can't measure it or carbon date it, so they tend to ignore it. I had the opportunity years ago to wander through the basement of a fairly well-apportioned museum, and some of the things they had locked up and they were dust-covered could well change how we look at earlier people. But they don't want to bring them out and discuss them because it tends to confuse folks. The Sumerian civilization came equipped with an intriguing mythology that explained their origins. The early texts insist that survivors from antediluvian civilization traveled to Mesopotamia after a catastrophic flood inundated their homeland, carrying with them the wisdom needed to begin the Sumerian culture. And these sages were ancestors who, according to the Sumerian tablets, lived in ancient times. So where did they come from? Where was this mysterious homeland? Archaeologists have yet to uncover it. Now, Graham Hancock wrote a book called Underworld. Puts forth the theory the homeland of the ancient Sumerian sages is now under the Persian Gulf. Long time ago, that area was dry land. If a now-submerged proto-civilization once existed there, the Sumerian problem won't be solved until we begin searching in the right place. It's a good theory that ties Sumerian mythology in with practical archaeology, which is what Zachariah Sitchin attempted to do. It explains the sudden appearance of Sumerian civilization. It takes into account the flood epics found in the ancient text. It also explains why an ancient civilization hadn't been found. Persian Gulf has been submerged for at least the last 14,000 years, and all that's needed is to push back the accepted dates of the beginning of civilization to revise the story we have all been taught in our history books. But that's the problem. Archaeologists prefer to find and discuss artifacts that fit a traditional story. But our accepted and approved story doesn't allow enough time in human development for pre-civilization to exist before the so-called first civilization. And to acknowledge such a revolutionary idea is to completely change everything the world of historical academia now believes to be true. I questioned some historical beliefs and produced evidence supporting my position, and I was denied entry into a PhD program because I wasn't a team player. In short, Hancock's theory implies that civilized, advanced human beings have been around a lot longer than now accepted. So we wind up in what amounts to a circular loop of arguments. Well, you know, first question is always asked, where's the evidence? Under the Persian Gulf. We have to die for it. Well, that costs money. We're not going to give you any support for your wild theory, dude. Come up with some sort of proof. Well, we can't find proof till you give us the money and support so we can go die for it. So we go round and round and round. When Hancock inquired about mounting an expedition on his own, he discovered he needed to obtain permission from officials in Iraq, the U.S. Navy, the CIA, Texaco, Iran, the King of Saudi Arabia, and the emirs of Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Sarhar, Abu Dhabi, and Dubai. Now, those are some interesting hoops to jump through before you can even begin to undertake something that's clearly apolitical and serves only to help us better understand the roots of human civilization. So the Sumerian problem is not likely to be solved anytime soon. But the Mesopotamian civilization began, undoubtedly, some rich and powerful cultures were subsequently born there. That area was an anchor of the fabled Fertile Crescent. For thousands of years, it was home to civilizations such as the Sumerians, the Assyrians, the Akkadians, and the Babylonians. These civilizations gave us legal codes and literature. They were one of the birthplaces of mathematics and astronomy. They produced city-states, ziggurats, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. They influenced such historic luminaries as Sargon, Akkad, and Cyrus the Great. They figured prominently in many ancient religious texts, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, the Enuma Elish in the Bible. Without Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, as it's called, our civilization would look a whole lot different than it does today. You know, the two words, Zeptepi, translates as the first time. It's the Egyptian equivalent of, in the beginning, God. Now, several writers I have followed said when they stood on the Giza Plateau, which I want to do, and saw the pyramids and the Sphinx, they had a humbling moment of awe and wonder because they might well be standing on the same spot of ground and surveying the same scene that once captured the attention of Alexander the Great, Cleopatra, the young Jesus, and innumerable other people of fame and legend. At Giza, if you can dodge all the hundreds of locals who want bakshish or sell you something, or the scam artist, you can really take a step backward in time. Just because people have been living here for thousands and thousands of years and no break in the culture doesn't mean the founding civilization is even close to being understood. When you listen to the arguments, and they do get heated, you soon come to the conclusion that the story of the first Egyptians who lived during the time of Zeptepi is lost in the mist of time. But if you look around with an open mind, there are clues everywhere. The problem doesn't come from a lack of evidence. Oh, no. The problem lies in how that evidence is interpreted. Now, some of the most ancient texts found in Egypt are called the Edfu Building Text. They tell the story of a group of sages who sailed the seven seas in large ships after their homeland was destroyed by a great flood. Can you say Atlantis? According to one of the sections of the tablets, the gods left their land after a great cataclysm had destroyed their island kingdom and sailed to another part of the primeval world. They journeyed through the lands of the primeval age. In any place they settled, they found new kingdoms. And the texts go on to some detail in describing the ancient gods. Builder gods who fashioned in that primeval time the lords of light, the ghosts, the ancestors who raised the seed for gods and men, the senior ones who came into being at the beginning and eliminated his land when they came forth united. When this story was told to an ancient Greek by the name of Solon, he eventually passed it down to an ancestor named Plato. And this was the beginning of the legend of what we now call the Atlantis tradition. Now, the ancient sages sought to pass on their wisdom to the Stone Age people who had survived the flood and were attempting to dig themselves out of the rubble. Their hope was to begin a new civilization. This all happened according to the Edfu text during the Zeptepi, or the first time. And it's no wonder the ancient Egyptians believed that the gods walked the earth back then. But right off the bat, we got a problem interpreting the evidence that we find of regarding early Egyptian civilization. Was what we call the beginning of their culture a true beginning, or was it a rebuilding with help from an even earlier civilization? It's easy to imagine a seafaring culture such as the one we now identify with the supposed mythical Atlantis civilization being devastated by a worldwide calamity. Now, this could possibly have been brought about by direct impact of a segmented comet that, according to many modern geologists, could have resulted in the end of the young Dryas Ice Age and been the trigger for a rapid rise in ocean levels. Part of this culture could have ridden out the devastation, especially if they were at sea when it happened. With their homeland destroyed, they might have decided to sail to a place as far apart as Egypt and Mesoamerica, where they taught primitive people lessons they had been painstakingly acquired down through the ages. Their advanced civilization might have been destroyed, but much of its wisdom could have been preserved in the language of mathematically coded building projects, waiting a day when another civilization would arise that would be intelligent enough to interpret those ancient secrets. Perhaps this explains why the Khufu ship was buried at the foot of the Great Pyramid 4,500 years ago. After all, what's a ship doing buried in the desert at the Giza Plateau? Traditionalists say it was built to provide transportation for the dead pharaoh who would need it during his voyage to the stars, but what do they use as the basis for this belief, other than sheer speculation? All of a sudden, the so-called myth of an Atlantis tradition takes on new meaning. This evidence has another possible explanation. In 1994, Robert Barville and Adrian Gilbert wrote The Orion Mystery. It brought into public scrutiny a theory that had been percolating in academic circles since the 60s. The basic idea was that the pyramids of Giza were built to mimic on Earth the position of the stars in the belt of the constellation Orion the Hunter. Now, Orion's one of the first constellations in the night sky that stargazers learned to identify. And the three stars in his belt are very easily spotted. They seem to form a straight line till you look closely and see one is slightly offset. And if you Google a map of Egypt, you'll see right away that the three pyramids are offset in identical fashion. Now, one of the principal gods of Egyptian religious mythology is Osiris. And an Osiris cult ruled Egypt for centuries. Osiris has been traditionally identified with Orion, so the relationship does make sense. And this identification was further enhanced when Egyptologists discovered a southern shaft running upward from the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid. During the age traditionally attributed to the building of the pyramids, it would have mimicked the barrel of a gun aimed at the belt of Orion. In Bovell's words, as recalled by Graham Hancock when he wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, which I've read, and it's a fascinating book, what I found was that the shaft had been precisely targeted on Anatok, the lowest of the three belt stars, which crossed the meridian at altitude 45 degrees around the year 2475 BC. And if you look carefully on a clear night, you'll see the smallest of the three stars, the one at the top, which the Arabs call Mintaka, is slightly offset to the east of the principal diagonal formed by the other two. And that pattern is mimicked on the ground where we see the pyramid of Menkaure is offset by exactly the right amount to the east of the principal diagonal formed by the pyramid of Khafre, which represents the middle star, Al-Nilam, and the Great Pyramid, which represents Al-Nidak. It's really quite obvious that all these monuments were laid out according to a unified site plan that was modeled with extraordinary precision on these three stars. What they did at Giza was to build Orion's belt on the ground. But you have to ask yourself, why would they have done this? What was the point? Now, for some reason, this insight riled traditional Egyptologists. Others were delighted. It was a theory that embraced traditional Egyptian mythology by placing the building of the pyramid within the accepted time spans. Now, there's been some theories about the pyramid perhaps being built millennia before. So this, at least, kept it within what was considered modern beliefs. Now, Bonneval wasn't content to leave it there, though. After carefully measuring the Giza architecture, reducing everything to the same scale, and then superimposing a map of the ground over a map of the heavens, he determined, although the general thrust of his theory could be seen in all eras, only one time frame occurred in which the stars were in an exact position to line up perfectly with his theory. And that was 10,450 B.C. As you might guess, the traditionalists didn't like it at all. They insisted no ancient civilization existed back in those days that was anywhere close to being able to construct something as sophisticated as what stood on the Giza Plateau. But then came the discovery of Göbekli Tepe. It was just as sophisticated, if not more so, and unquestionably came before the pyramids by at least 5,000 years. Well, nobody could say that no previous human civilization existed that was capable of building complex structures. There was the evidence right in front of them. Now, according to conventional wisdom, the pyramids simply couldn't have been built any earlier than 6,000 years ago. Because only Paleolithic humans existed then, they just couldn't have done it. But they did do something similar at least 5,000 years before that. So the battle lines were drawn again. Two groups squared off. One took the 2,475 B.C. date as gospel truth. The other jumped aboard the 10,450 B.C. ancient civilization train. And that's where things stood for a while until more information threw another complication into this bubbling stew of Egyptology. Right next to the pyramids stands, or if you want to be accurate, reclines, an even more enigmatic structure. It's called the Sphinx. And nothing about this structure quite fits traditional thinking. First, it's carved into native bedrock and represents the body of a lion with the head of a man. Makes no sense at all unless you offer some purely speculative motives for the project. And that's the problem. Too many influential archaeologists have replaced facts with speculation. And second, although the traditional story is it was built at the same time as the pyramids, the image has absolutely nothing in common with them. It's totally out of context. Because it's carved into bedrock, it sits in a deep well of sorts, which is constantly filling up with drifting sand. For thousands of years at a time, only the head was sticking up out of the desert. Nobody even knew about the lion body until they got excavated. And since so much has been written about the riddle of the Sphinx, the easiest thing to do is to simply summarize the arguments. Traditional Egyptologists usually say the whole complex, pyramids and Sphinx together, were built at roughly the same time. About 2575 to 2467 B.C. by three pharaohs of the 4th dynasty, Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure. Their Greek names are Cheops, Sephron, and Mycerinus. According to accepted doctrine, the pyramids were built as tombs. Nothing more esoteric was involved. Theory is officially called tombs and tombs only. Anything else is usually referred to as New Age nonsense and lumped together with ancient aliens and so-called lost civilizations. According to the powers that be, Giza's a necropolis. It's a home for the dead, and that's it. Nothing to see. Move along. Well, if that's the case, though, how do we explain the Sphinx? Doesn't seem to have much to do with burying somebody. No tombs inside it. And if traditionists say, well, that's easy, the Sphinx bears the head of Pharaoh Khafre, who had it built as a monument to his glory. Others, though, aren't quite so quick to accept that, which is, when you get right down to it, just sheer speculation. Although it's an official speculation. Ignoring the obvious question that if Khafre was already building a pyramid, why'd he need a lion as well? They point out two major problems that have yet to be answered. After careful inspection, years of arguing and hundreds, if not thousands, of carefully worded and peer-reviewed papers, the consensus now seems to be the head of the Sphinx is a modified addition to the original statue. In other words, the head was originally that of a lion, just like the rest of the structure. Now, Khafre, if he had anything at all to do with it, probably had it re-sculptured to look like him. And this, of course, implies the Sphinx does indeed bear his likeness, but it could just as easily be somebody else. Does this mean that Sphinx originally crafted before Khafre's time and is therefore older than the accepted dates of the pyramids? Well, that could be, but then you have the question of how much older. And that brings up the second point. The Sphinx has spent so much of its time over the course of thousands of years buried in the drifting sand of the Giza Plateau. It's only when somebody takes the time and invests the effort to dig it out that it's exposed to erosion and wear, but the body, the oldest original portion of the figure, shows unmistakable signs of water erosion. Well, we're in a desert. How can this be? It doesn't rain in the Sinai, at least not enough to cause the kind of visible wear evidenced on the Sphinx. Well, it turns out the Sinai is actually a young desert. It wasn't always dry. 11 to 15,000 years ago, the Giza Plateau was a well-watered, palm-covered paradise. Now, while it would make no sense to build such a great edifice in the way it was guaranteed to cover it up with drifting sand, it would have made perfect sense to build it back when it was surrounded by lush forests and grass that enjoyed abundant rain. So this makes the Sphinx at least 11,000 years old. Way too old for traditional Egyptologists. So after a lot of argument, which is ongoing even today, the answer to the age of both the Sphinx and the Egyptian Zeptepi might lie in the science of astronomy. Assume for a minute the Sphinx originally aligned in both head and body, and that certainly makes sense and is a reasonable starting point. Does its position reveal anything about its age? Well, the line on the Giza Plateau, assuming that's what it is, faces due east. Every spring equinox, the day when night and day are equal in length, it's therefore positioned to watch the sunrise. But behind that sunrise is a particular constellation of the zodiac. One such constellation is Leo, the lion. So when did the sun last rise in the constellation of Leo behind it on the morning of the spring equinox? During the span of years, it ran from about 12,800 to 11,600 years ago, precisely the era of the Younger Dryas Ice Age. And when was the Giza Plateau less favored with a rainy climate? Exactly at that same time frame. When do both the Edfu text and the contemporary Egyptologists place the Zeptepi, or the first time, the age when the primal gods of Egypt began the Egyptian civilization? At that same point in time. And when did Plato say the Atlantis catastrophe occurred? At that same point in time. Well, Graham Hancock explained this very clearly in his book, The Magicians of the Gods, which I've also read. The essence of the argument is that there was an ancient globally distributed doctrine, as above, so below, that set out quite deliberately to create monuments on the ground that copied the patterns of certain scientific significant constellations in the sky. And moreover, since the position of all stars changes slowly but continuously as a result of the precession, it is possible to use particular configurations of astronomically aligned monuments to deduce the dates they represent. Well, when you get right down to it, this is a pretty convincing argument. The evidence may be circumstantial, but is it any less than the evidence presented for a later date of construction? If, in fact, the Anunnaki are those that were referred to as the ancient gods, it makes everything Sitchin wrote look more and more correct. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night and talk more about ancient civilizations. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.